our stories become. You hear so many different people talk, and at the root of it, it's usually fear, or it's usually something really, you know, sad that that happens to us. I, after being in the program now for a little while, have worked hard to figure out where it all started and what happened to me. And I think I was born with this malady. I really believe that in my heart, because I was never comfortable in my own skin. I was never without fear. I don't remember ever being, of course, you don't remember when you're 2 or 3 or 4, but ever as far back as I can remember, I was always afraid. And fear's a thing that is not easy to live with when you're a kid, or probably even as an adult. I don't think of myself today as anything short of a miracle, really, because I didn't really do this. I thank, in the order like this, I thank God, I thank my family. Now, I got to be careful tonight, because after God, there's the next boss in line, and she's here. And, you know, she's been at my side for almost 32 years, and if I say the wrong thing, it might be a long weekend, so I got to be a little careful. But this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I got to be honest. So, you know, but in all reality, my family would be the next thing, then Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsors, and my friends. And when I say my friends, I don't think I've ever really had friends until my arrival here. I don't think those people that I chose to hang with were friends. I think they were convenient to hang with, and they helped me to get what I needed, and served as company while I entertained myself and got through whatever I had to do. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on my young or growing up, but I will say that there was some predisposition to the disease of addiction and alcoholism, more on the addiction side. But at 13 years old, I had two friends come over, and I had never, you know, had a drink or a drug before, but it was New Year's Eve. I had the house alone. I had two friends come over. We each put in $5. And decided that, because my dad was in the wholesale liquor business, there was a lot of booze in the garage, I said, I'm going to steal 3 bottles of Black Velvet, which was Canadian whiskey, and we're going to go in the backyard, and whoever could finish their bottle first would win the $15. So I want to tell you that the whole bet lasted about 30 minutes, and I don't think any of us got to the shoulder of the bottle, and then we were all three on all fours, and we were, you know, exhaling our intestines. But here's the key part, that for about 30 minutes in that evening, I became like Superman, and all of a sudden, this scared little kid, real little, I was really little, that couldn't get, you know, comfortable in any fashion by myself, was ready to call the girls, was ready to play the sports, was ready to pick a fight, was ready to stand up to anything in my way. And that's when the hurling started. But before that, I really got brave for about a half hour. And when I finally recovered from that illness over the holiday and went back to school, I looked for those same kids and asked them, like, let's do it again. And they looked at me like I was, you know, from another world. And I knew, I think now looking back, I made a conscious decision to seek different friends. Friends that wanted to feel better than we do on a regular, natural basis. I did not like the way I felt on a regular basis. And the only time I hated authority, like Rhonda said, she didn't like the word no. I hated all authority, and it meant, like, at home, you know, you'll finish your dinner. No, I won't. About no, I won't. And I got beat for that, or I got yelled at for that. You know, all my siblings were pretty well behaved. I was pretty well behaved, but I had this thing about, you know, rebellion and authority. I hated school. I can never remember enjoying a single day of school. We were told we would go to college, we would be successful, we would work hard. That was the way it was. The only part of that that got through in my head was working hard. I heard that because my father, who had a lot of faults, he was a smart guy, he was a great provider, but he was also a gambler, and he was also addicted to painkillers. And his basic philosophy was, I'm the breadwinner, and if it involves money or needs, I'll come through. The rest of it's on you, meaning to my mom. And when it was something where he would rarely, though, have conversation with his children, it would be on us. Well, so I always resented that, and I always thought, you know, if I ever grow up and I ever have kids and a wife, you know, I will never, like, be that way. Well, I'm here to tell you that I became him in many ways. Not, my wife will get upset if I say that without disclaiming, but, it, you know, because I was an active father and I took an active role in raising my children, and I love my children, and, you know, they're probably the single most important things in my entire life. But when it came to my habit of drinking and drugging, a lot of times, you know, I would make sure I allocated the time that it took and the money that it took to feed my addiction and to feed my habit and my sickness as the same as I would allocate those same assets for my family. You know, I was I enjoyed a good career. I enjoyed a tremendous career for about 25 years. I was in the wholesale business, and I was probably one of the five best in this country at what I did. And it kind of got to my head, like I had arrived, you know. And so what would happen is every time I had a good job, this illness would cost me that job. And I would see it coming. I would see it coming a month or two or three before it actually happened. And I would think, well, you know, I'm so good that if they fire me, I'll just outsmart them and I'll get another job. And they would ultimately fire me or come real close to like a day or two short of it. And I would say, hey, I hate to tell you, but I'm leaving. I got a better offer. And I would skedaddle to the next company. And I did that two or three times and got away with it. And instead of coming home and telling my family that, you know, I got myself in trouble because of this little problem that I have, I would lie, and I would say that, you know, I have an opportunity to better my career, to enhance my income, and I would go and do what I had to do, knowing that I was going to probably lose my job. And I did that a few times. And in 1998, I happened to come across the dream job that I really always wanted, and a company that just treated me like one of them, and it was a family. And I worked hard and did well there for 6+ years. But when that man fired me, it was game over, because the industry had gone south. The exposure of some of my idiot behavior had been noticed. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. Well, I knew what was coming. I didn't know how to do it. I had been on this planet 50 years, and I had been, in some way or another, impaired for about 33 of them. So it was time to come and face reality. So I went home, and being the proactive con man that I am, I went home and told my family that I got fired, lost my job, and I need help. And that was the first admission ever that I needed help. Now, you know, my family knew that I had a problem. My kids are smart. My wife is even smarter. She's an educator. She's not one of us. And she's the kind of person that she knows me so well. And she, you'll have to ask her why she stuck around so long, because it's really, really hard for me sometimes to figure out how such a beautiful soul with such potential to probably find any life she wanted would settle for a, you know, drunken drug addict like me. And even though we had good times, it was a painful relationship when those moments of crisis would come. And they weren't often, but they were ugly. They were ugly, and they were much more, for her, painful, because I was numb. You know, I would need those medications and drinking and drugging to just face life. I did not know how to face life without it. So just to wind it down into more of the better days, which came afterward. At 50 years old, I lost my job. I came to a detox. I got clean. And even though I wasn't quite ready, I played around for a few more days. But on October 30th, which was the day the West Side Men's Group had its breakfast in Plantation, which was about 500 alcoholics, I decided to be very active in this breakfast committee, and I wore a tie, and I greeted people at the door. I was there the night before setting up, and then just as the speaker was being introduced, I kind of like collapsed in my plate, and they drove me home, you know, almost unconscious. And it was that day that, in 2004, that I thought my family really was going to leave me. I was on the drive home from that breakfast. They told me they were going to leave me. When I was screaming and hollering on the floor of the bathroom that night, laying on the cold tile in my own body fluids, screaming for them, they didn't show up. And that's the night that I actually screamed out for God. And somehow or other made it till sunlight and begged my wife to give me another shot, and told her that I would seek the right kind of help, and that this time I meant it, because I really, really thought that they were gone. I thought they were gone. And you know, my children, they would do anything to always avoid a conflict between Vicky and I. We would fight over a broken dish or a trip to Disney or something. You know, they would make the peace immediately because they didn't want to blow the trip. This time, they didn't come to my rescue. They were sick of what my behavior looked like, and they didn't say it, but they, by saying nothing, I knew it, and I felt like a piece of garbage. I felt so low that I knew that now I had no choice but to get sober. And from there, it gets to be a wonderful story, because I went back to my home group with a new perspective. I asked some people with a lot of time who a sponsor would be for me. I got the right sponsor. I went through the steps. I was still, you know, a little unsure about how the spiritual side of AA comes together with not getting high. I didn't really understand that. But when I went to a jail with 1 year and a day to speak before 150 inmates at Conti, I was so terrified that I can't even tell you what I said. But I know that afterward, there were about 8 or 10 inmates waiting to thank me and to tell me that they enjoyed my message. And that was the first day that I really felt like maybe I really can help somebody else, because that's the theme of the program is, you know, you can't keep it unless you give it away. And today, it's a different program for me today. I have a sponsor, I have sponsees. I have had most of the service positions in my own group. I am a member of the Broward County Institutions Committee, which takes meetings to institutions, jails, hospitals, detoxes, and anywhere that alcoholics can't get out to meetings of their own. I have a support group and a group of friends that is second to none. I have an unbelievable group of friends, men that I love, men that I have intimate, not gay, intimate relationships with. I have a family today that, I mean, the Father's Day and birthday cards over the past few years that I have, I mean, when I read those cards, I tell you that's the most joyous thing that's ever happened to me, is to their own writing. That's not Hallmark. This is their writing to Dad, who we're so proud of you and what you've done for our family and for us and for yourself, you know. And, you know, it's a tough time. I had, I think, this week the toughest AA week ever in my sobriety. I had a brother-in-law die last Saturday, and that's the good news. He leaves behind, I told you I had 3 siblings. Robin, my sister, 3 years younger, she died of an overdose in 1998. She left behind at that time a 4-year-old and a 9-year-old. Today those are 20 and 25 years old. They are both in the throes of this disease so bad that impenetrable, you know, like just like me. At 25, you couldn't have told me about recovery. I would have told you to go fly a kite. I just didn't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. Well, you know, we had to go to a funeral last Wednesday, just a few days ago, and watch them and their friends carrying on in the church. And they're not reachable now. They're fighting. They were left a bunch of money. And, you know, I'm powerless to help them. I can tell them I love them. Over and over again, I can tell them that if they want to get help, if they want to become willing to live a different kind of life, that my phone is open 24/7. I can tell them that. But I can't kidnap them and take them to a meeting. I can't, if they're not willing, I can't help them at all. And now they have no parents. They have no parents. They're all alone. And they are in such denial that it's tragic. And it's, I see, you know, reminds me of the pain that I put my parents through, even though they were around for a lot longer. My mom is still fine and she's 82 years old, but she had to be there in that room listening to her daughter's death reiterated a few more times. My Vicky, my love of my life, has had some health problems, and we're getting them a little more and more under control. But this whole summer, she's been through hell with medical probing and, you know, poking and every imaginable test. And to see her as brave and courageous and non-complaining about it. It gives me so much to strive for that I've not yet achieved. You know, I'm a coward in that way. I mean, you get near me with a needle, I'm not happy. I'm running. And she takes it in stride, and together we have a spiritual connection. We have of a love connection. We have our children, and it's all one good, you know, circle of love today. It's not, there's no static, and the static that was there was my fault. So today, by doing this thing one day at a time, I can keep that circle intact. I can help other alcoholics. I do try to do that on a daily basis. Like Doug said, you can't be perfect in your in practicing these principles, but as long as you do the best that you can, I think God will accept that as an effort. And if no one today told you that they loved you, then I'm going to tell you I love you. Thank you for letting me share.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Doug. And thank you so much, Larry. And there's something else I forgot. Is there anyone here celebrating this week? No one celebrating? Sure. All right. Is there anyone here from out of town? If I can introduce themselves.
Sam Alcoholic.
Welcome, Sam. And is there anyone? Oh, yes.
Rich Alcoholic.
Hey, Rich. And is there anyone here for the first time?
Jason, Addict Alcoholic.
Welcome, welcome, Jason. Welcome. Well, welcome. Yeah. Joey, welcome. Welcome. And let's thank our two speakers again, please. And anyone who would care to join, we have a nice way of closing with the Lord's Prayer.
Spiel.
I am messed up today.
You're having a hard time today.
Yeah. Well, everybody can get around in a circle. Yeah. First, we'll do a Long John Silver's spiel. If you see someone without a smile,
give them yours.
It's nice to be important, but make the rest of your life
the best of your life.
At last but not least, may you all live as long as you want.
Never walk as long as you live.
Who made the rivers and saved our livers?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.
What's up? Yo, what's up?